Campus FM presents the 15th Annual St. Augustine Lecture 2011. This lecture is delivered by Professor Alberto Boccati.
Your Grace,
Monsignor Tommaso Caputo, Apostolic Nuncio of Malta, ladies and gentlemen, good evening, and I welcome you to the on behalf of the Augustinian Institute, the Faculty of Theology, and the Foundation for Theological Studies, to this 15th edition of the annual St. Augustine Lecture. 30 years ago today, November 22nd, Blessed Pope John Paul II's apostolic exhortation on the Christian family in the modern world, Familiaris Consortio, was published. Familiaris Consortio is considered as the Magna Carta for the pastoral care of marriage and the family life. It is the reference point per excellence for all those with a heart for families and a desire to serve them to live their authentic human and Christian identity and vocation. It sets out the path by which the Church and society can come to appreciate more fully the heart of the deepest truth about marriage and family life. As Pope Benedict XVI recently stated, in Familiaris Consortio, Christian married couples are exhorted to give witness to their faith by proclaiming the gospel of family and life. In view of today's ideological and cultural changes which are challenging the nature and identity of the family, this mission entrusted to Christian families by Familiaris Consortio has become more urgent and pertinent. Particularly in today's culture of debt, biotechnology is luring many families to renounce their vocation to defend the dignity of the human being from its conception to natural death. Moreover, ideological powers are projecting new models of marriage and the family, which are undermining the stability of social, of civil society. It is my pleasure and honor to introduce this evening our guest lecturer, Prof. Alberto Boccati, who shall deliver the keynote lecture precisely to commemorate Familiaris Consortio, the Gospel of Family and Life, Ideological and Cultural Changes on the 30th Anniversary of Familiaris Consortio. Professor Boccati is the Director of the Department of Bioethics at the Faculty of Theology at the University of Buenos Aires and a member of the Pontifical Council for Bioethics. He is Professor of Moral Theology at the Augustinianum Patristic Institute. Professor Boccati holds a licentiate degree in Moral Theology from Alfonsiana Academy, a master's degree in Bioethics from John Paul II Pontifical Institute for Studies on Marriage and the Family. He is president of the Institute of Marriage and Family at the Pontifical Catholic University of Argentina. He is the former director of the Institute of Bioethics at the School of Medicine, Pontifical Catholic University of Argentina. He is also the consultant for the Congregation for the Causes of Saints. Professor Boccati is a member of the Academic Council of Ethics in Medicine, National Academy of Medicine Argentina, and a visiting scholar at the Center for Clinical Bioethics at Georgetown University, Washington, D.C. Professor Boccati published a number of articles in academic journals, and he co-edited a number of books. I thank you, Professor Boccati, for accepting once again our invitation to come to Malta. This is your second visit to our country, and we are looking forward to enlighten us on this important document, the Magna Carta of the pastoral care of families and marriages in today's challenging world, which is really a challenge in today's ideological and cultural changes. Professor Alberto Bocetei.
Thank you, Professor Sinclair. Your Excellency, Mr. Civil Authorities present, Father Dean of the Faculty of Theology, and Father Salvino, President of the Augustinian Institute, thank you very much for the presentation and for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be back in Malta. And I want to thank you also, Monsignor Jean Lafitte, Secretary of the Pontifical Council of Family in Rome, which helped me very much for these conferences and allowed me to use some of his material. We just finished at the end of September a big activity on family and marriage in Argentina. We celebrate four different seminaries and congresses in four different regions, areas, geographical areas in Argentina, and Monsignor Lafitte and Monsignor Vázquez, also from the Pontifical Council of Family, did a very good help for our activity to celebrate Familiaris Consortio. And now I have the opportunity to share this conference here. And as you already know, my Spanish background is strong in my accent. I apologize for my English. That is another challenge in our days. The theme with which I have been entrusted concerns the institution of the family, which encounters difficulties and challenges such that could not have been foreseen only 30 or 40 years ago. When Familiaris Consortio was published, many of the problems or challenges we face in our days were simple, didn't exist, and even we didn't think they were able to exist in a few years. In speaking to its baptized children, the Church necessarily speaks of an economy of grace rooted in baptism and poured out through sacramental marriage. If we have the curiosity to consider the inter-ecclesial debates relative of marriage before the 1960s, we would see the conglomeration of questions related to unity of marriage, fidelity, fecundity, Christian education of children, all accompanied by the call to the classic means of sanctification, prayer and sacraments, and in particular the Sunday Eucharist. Of course, a certain innovation had already appeared with Pius XI when he spoke in Castico Nubi of the sanctification of the spouses, those directing the attention to the contracting persons and not anyone only in the sacrament dress. In all of this, however, we recognize the marriage did not interest the theologian and the moralist except insofar as it had canonical consequences. No one could have ever imagined that that was accepted in the great majority of the cultures regarding the definition of marriage would soon be the object of a radical reconsideration. From the natural law viewpoint, foundation of Roman law, in as much as common law, marriage designated for society a stable union, freely consented to by one man and one woman, so as to found a family. The sharing by the spouse of their two existing supposes a certain number accepted realities, readiness to welcome, raise and meet the needs of their children. In the countries where there existed for historical reasons a dual tradition, religious and civil, expressed by the existence of a religious marriage side by side with a civil marriage, this disparity did not implicate any difficulty regarding the content itself of that which was contracted, a reciprocal engagement to a common life for all of life. The first blow inflicted upon the vision was without a doubt the introduction into the law of the authorization of civil divorce, which fostered the mentality that in certain extreme cases, such a decision could be taken to the end of life in common. But few years later, we discovered that the civil divorce was only for certain extreme cases, but for mutual consent. This is to say that there is a tranquil alternative to stable conjugal life. And more late in our days, we discovered several countries that have civil divorce just for one consent. One part can decide to divorce even without notice the other partner. We see that when we say that was an introduction of a big change, when it's not only a religious concern, it's a matter of fact. We already see these realities. Unfortunately, the question of divorce is not only one pose. We could describe the last century as the one which is starting the sexual revolution, has conducted us toward an ideology today that is still more grave, even if it itself is just a fruit, that which is the ideology of gender. It seems to me useful to delineate some milestone points within this evolution, as this will help us to better understand how we have arrived to the contemporary situation. The sexual revolution refers all the changes which occurred in Western society and spreading out today therefrom of the vision of sexuality and its exercise, such that there is a sort of moral emancipation. The revolution is of philosophical, anthropological, moral, and a social nature. At the moral level, it acts as a reveal of ethics, lifestyle, and laws in many countries. The revolution consists in the discourse regarding human sexuality, limited until that point to its links with procreation. Soon, all considerations of sexual attitudes of men and women were to cease to be taboo. Subjects never publicly discussed before became the object of common conversation in the media, in the families, in particular the practice of feminine or masculine homosexuality, the search of maximum pleasure in the relationship like the main goal in sexuality, the request for a sexuality separated from all commitment and responsibility. And let me very briefly line out some scheme. If we spoke in the 70s, we can start in 68 with all the revolution and Gustock and the Velvet Spring and whatever. Related in sexuality, we discover a big brokenness between sex and love. In the 80s, 1978, Louis Brown, the first in vitro baby was born. In the 80s, another big brokenness appeared between sex and procreation. We don't need sex anymore, we need the lab. In the 90s, between sex and nature, we transfer cells. We don't even need the cells. We can create, with quote mark, a human being. And in the 2000s, between sex and person, we broke the concept of anthropological conception of sexuality. That will take. It will be interesting, but it will take a long time to express. We understand that a discourse which exalts sexuality in its various forms and at times in a contradictory manner contributes to reversal of all the values that have held societies together through the centuries. Exclusivity of the loving relation between spouses, veneration of human life, love of children, a sense of personal and family history. What exactly is gender? It is an ideology that attempts to affirm that the differences between men and women, above and beyond their anatomical particularities, do not correspond to a fixed nature, but are products of the culture of a particular epoch of determinate place. The difference between the sexes is considered as a social convention. Everyone can attribute to oneself the sex that they choose. At the level of behavior, everyone can choose heterosexuality, masculine or feminine homosexuality, and bisexuality, or whatever. It became possible to change sexes. The legislations of different countries, in as much as the international organizations, attempt to establish and impose the recognition of the new rights, gender rights. Permit me to refer to the United Nations Declaration of Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity, which was presented to the General Assembly of the United Nations on December 18, 2008. The declaration, which was to be adopted as a resolution, sparked a declaration of opposition from the part of the Arab League. For the record, 68 countries supported the declaration, with 57 countries opposing it, with the two declarations remaining open for new signatures, as neither of the texts were officially adopted by the General Assembly. The dissociation of sex and gender, another big wrongness, divide between nature and culture. It contributes to reduce the human being to mere individuality and subjectivity. Let us note that it does this through the negation of nature's most fundamental determinism. To conclude this part, let us cite Sulmaith Firestone, a feminist writer. She wrote in 1970, "Thus, the natural is not necessarily a human value. Humanity has begun to transcend nature. We can no longer justify the maintenance of the discriminatory sex class system on grounds of its origins in nature. Indeed, for programmatic reasons alone, it is beginning to look as if we must get rid of it." And let me tell you that this feminist perspective of gender took the Marxist theory. They say that Marx was wrong, thinking that the only liberation of the poor people will be the social problems, fix the social work system. They say he forgot to the sexual system, change the sexual system. You know? And she says, women are the workers, men are the oligarchs, and we have this battle and this duality, and they develop a neo-Marxist theory on sex basis. This is very, very interesting, and normally we don't speak, people don't know about that, and the ideology goes and goes. Let's go back to our main questions. The nature of the problem, anthropological aspect, and moral implications. In all the elements that we have indicated regarding the deconstruction of the family and the human being in his, her sexual dimension, one can discern an ideological intention aiming to totally change the very terms themselves of the conjugal and familial contract. Before being a moral question, the problem regards the conception of the nature of men and women, and those of human love, which the desired change reveal. That which characterizes all the ideologies of the world in the abstract character of considering the problems. The formidable gender ideology simply forgets that the family is not merely an idea, but contrarily, a practical experience. The concrete experience of the family. The family experience teaches us some things about love between a man and a woman, but it also raises the deepest questions at the heart of each of us. Blaise Jean Paul II was accustomed to talking about fundamental human experiences. But the term experience should be clarified. It means an experience lived. In short, we can say that the human experience includes both the sensitive aspect of humankind, which it stimulates, and its own intelligibility. It's not only emotions. It's an experience of fundamental values, experience of life. The Christian anthropologist Jean Moreau said the experience exists in these regards when men conceive of himself in relationship to the world, himself, and God. What is true of every human experience applies particularly to the fundamental experience of love. The being other than oneself can be contemplated in what reveals him or her specifically to the other, his or her body. We recall that it's the fact that Jean Paul II used as the basis for developing his thought on the original experience of the body in the first part of his catechesis on human love. According to him, love is accompanied by the discovery of the nuptial dimension, la dimensione sponsale in Italian, of the body, perceptible in what is called the ethos of gift. It is interesting to see how the Blessed Jean Paul II successor expresses this intrinsic link between love and truth after having proclaimed with a certain boldness the existence of a divine eros. Benedict XVI sees the truth of love in a balance between eros and agape, and not in the separation of these two aspects. I quote, "Eros and agape, ascending love and descending love, can never be completely separated. The more the two, in their different aspects, find a proper unity in the one reality of love, the more the true nature of love in general is realized." This is from Deus Caritas Est, number 4. Caritas in Veritate emphasizes the oblative aspect of love that finds in gifts its true aspect, not cut off from its transcendent scope. Charity in truth places man before the astonishing experience of gift. Gratuitousness is present in our life in many different forms, which often goes unrecognized because of a purely consumerist and utilitarian view of life. The human being is made for gift, which expresses and makes present his transcendent dimension. Caritas in Veritate, number 34. In order to understand the true nature of family, there are two transitions that must be made: from love to marriage, and from marriage to family. The fact of marrying lends the experience of love its social aspects. It takes it beyond the boundaries of interpersonal intimacy and enriches it by equipping it with a new significance. The very existence of the conjugal union, civil or religious, means the society retains an interest in what happens between spouses and considers the relationship to be a good. It will therefore be the authority it holds, grant it the means of stability, because it's a good. Society incorporates as a new piece of information the fact that within it, this particular man and this particular woman have been joined in a unique way that not only commits them for the future, but also requires society to take note of this union, to demonstrate its interest and stream, to help it establish itself or grow stronger, and to view as an enrichment the possibility that it might expand to become a family. Let us examine the experience of somebody gradually discovering that he or she is a member of a family. It was the experience of the vast majority of people, I guess all of us, until a few decades ago, an experience of which we are aware from early childhood. How can we not the thing at this point of John Paul's famous letter of family, in which he referred on the object of the conception and birth of a child, the genealogy of the person? Bound up with the family is the genealogy of every individual, the genealogy of the person. The personal aspect of the event, found on its full meaning in his eyes, is the fact that every person is created in the image and resemblance of God. The second point of view is that the spouses. The coming into existence of one or more children challenges the nature of what they have experienced so far. Not only does the child introduce one to the new experience of fatherhood, of the other to the experience of motherhood, but they consider themselves to be father and mother through each other, so it is that their love takes one a new, far broader dimension, taking them, both, well beyond the limits of a couple, to a family unit that transcends their relationship. Family, society's point of view, is leading us towards the end of this relationship. Up until the last few decades, it was commonly accepted in all legislations that the family was founded on public commitment between a man and a woman. The recent extension of the terms family and marriage to other forms of social reality weakened the perception of the structural and founding tie between marriage and the family. Certainly, at the beginning of this millennium, the family institution retains a presence in a number of societies that it binds and unifies. It is, however, suffering dangerously at the hands of Western countries that are constantly attempting to impose and export their social and cultural models. Instead of any specifically ethical consideration of the matter, it is with an anthropological model that we are now confronted. One that consists of taking about people slowly in an individualistic manner as an isolated entity with absolute freedom, ignoring their original social aspect, and no longer viewing marriage and family as natural society rooted, specifically in the natural society of man and woman. We should also consider here that the disappearance of stability could mean in terms of population and replacement of generations. The encyclical Caritas in Veritate, which has in mind the very future of human society, calls on legislation to honor and encourage the family for reasons that are not only ethical, but above all, concern the very survival of social ties. It is within the culture of the family that society will find the means to ensure cohesion and to develop fundamental relationship of solidarity as well as reason to place hope in the future. The personal difficulty of an enduring engagement, which is very common in young people. From the point of view of young candidates to marriage, one observes a growing difficulty to assume an enduring engagement. The existence in the large number of legal systems of the possibility to divorce has contributed to the loss of the sense of indissolubility and beauty of marriage. These loss arise when marriage candidates fail to understand the difference between a marriage forever. And this is interesting, we're talking with one of you which is preparing a paper on this topic to the preparation for the marriage, that the young couples wants to hear from the church teaching, not the medical issues or the social, political issues of marriage and family, but what the church, the gospel, the magisterium has to say for them. There are various tools for teaching indissolubility. On a rational level, it is the nature of a gift that cannot be taken back. If I receive a gift, I cannot give back. Moreover, the intimate union of two spouses creates between them a reality which introduces a new situation, the existence of a couple recognized by everyone and then of an established family. The eventual existence of children teaches something about the reality of marriage that transcends the individual subjectivity of the spouses. Openness to life, expectations of the spouses and God's plan. It is essential to talk to the engaged couple about their attitude towards human life. Marriage, blessed by the Church, is completed with the transmission of life. It is only right and proper that the priest discuss with them their intention in this regard. Openness to life is the point at which converge on one hand the expectation of the spouse and on the other the plan of God the Creator. Engaged couples should be helped to understand that when planning to have a child and performing the acts of transmitting life, they do so as partners of the Creator. The Bible considers having a child a special blessing. The desire to have a child is not only a natural yearning held deep in the heart of every human being, but is also an act of recognition of the freedom of God the Creator, who alone has the power to call to life a new human being from the union of the two spouses. A key element when the issue of birth control comes up is to confirm clearly and tactfully the teaching of the Magisterium of the Church. The engaged couple must be made aware that the contraceptive practice, also used with the best intentions, seriously alter the physical expression of their love, and that is why they are contrary to God's will. One difficulty in this area comes from the lack of clarity of many priests and many married mentors couples about the moral implication of the teaching of the Magisterium of the Church on human love. I don't have the time to go in this issue, but it's interesting. It's a challenge, especially for priests and very devout couples. When the issue of the transmission of life is treated with care and simplicity, it is possible to show the beauty of the conjugal act through the richness of its dual meaning, unitive and procreative. If you talk with respect and conviction, it becomes easier to stress that the two dimensions of the conjugal act cannot be separated deliberately without affecting the authentic beauty of the marriage union. There are surely other anthropological problems that we cannot address in this moment right now. For example, the confusion of roles and functions of the spouse is very common to hear. Well, I'm a single mother, but I do the same like father and mother. No. Probably this lady are doing a very magnificent job, a very hard job, educating the child, but it's not a father, it's a mother. Also, with the homosexual adoption, they can give two fathers, two mothers, but not a mother, which is worse. Because they want to have a baby, they take away the possibility for these children to have the experience of mother or father, depending the sex of the parents. And it's a big question. In this last part, I want to propose three essential elements of the Catholic response. First, the adequate anthropology. Second, the non-negotiable principles. And third, mercy and pastoral prudence. When one speaks of a good news item, he refers of two things. At the natural level, it concerns a discovery that the subject makes. Man discovers himself loved It is the original experience of the child who is revealed to himself by the unconditional love of his parents. The love will make him, little by little, sense the existence of another love that is even more fundamental and more ultimate, the provident love of his Creator, the God's love. In a more precise sense, a good news story refers to a revelation of the supernatural order. In the case of human love, we very well have a revelation illustrated by the astonishing dialogue between Jesus and the Pharisees in chapter 19 of the Gospel of St. Matthew. The Pharisees pose a trick question to Jesus on liberty that the law of Moses permitted repudiating a wife by drafting up a decree of repudiation. Their question finds itself unequally at the level of what is permitted, defended, on the obligation of the law. In this sense, it is superficial and demonstrates well that they have no idea that love might have a meaning, that there exists a beauty of love. The response of Jesus is such, at the beginning it was not so. Have you not read that from the beginning the Creator made the male and female? For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. In our times, at the beginning, the love of God is the love of the Creator, the love of the beginning, and we must be faithful to that love. It reflects a fullness of meaning, a divine deliberation of the Creator that created the world and formed man as man and woman. In that which concerns human love, we very much have a revelation in the measure that it is Christ himself who unveils it in the Scriptures, in her own life. The content of his revelation is an invitation to contemplate the beauty present within the same nature of love, a beauty that is inscribed within creation and where is revealed by way of nuptial symbols, a steadfast love that unites Christ to his Church. In the Wesley Catechism of Human Love of John Paul II, that I quote already, makes a link between the love of man and woman and the creation of all mankind in the image of God. In his eyes, the fullness of created man is manifested by a communion of person expressed by sexual complementarity. He wrote, "Man came to be an image of God not so much in the moment of solitude as in the moment of communion. Since the beginning, in effect, he was not only the image in which he reflects the solitude of a person who governs the world, but also, and essentially, the image of inscrutable divine communion of persons." This is very interesting. You know, another word which is forbidden now to speak is complementarity. For many feminists and for the ideology of gender, is discriminative, is offended. I'm full of myself. I don't need to be complementary for anyone. But it's not an anthropological view. No, it's selfish to believe that you don't need others. We are persons when we are in relation, personare, no, with the others. This is really very beautiful, but I will leave the full text with Father Caruana. Second, the non-negotiable principles. The first demand is that mutual consent. The reciprocity of the gifts is an objective verification of love and certainly is a condition for the happiness of the spouses. This liberty does not cause a problem for secularized society, but one often forgets that the public character and the exchange of consent adopted by civil laws and which offers certain guarantee that the marriage has been freely contracted finds its origin within the proper laws of the Church, the Messy Decree. The canonical disposition which aimed to combat clandestine marriages has contributed to protecting women from possible abuses. The second demand is that the irrevocable character of the conjugal covenant, another beautiful word that is lost, covenant. Even there, one imagines a distortion that the indissolubility of the bond is particularity of the Catholic Church. It is true that the sacrament reinforces and consolidates indissolubility. It does not bring it into existence. Indissolubility is born of the interior demand of a covenant between the spouses. It is not an exterior addition, but rather, on the contrary, a permanent quality proper to a marriage validly contracted. Why? Because marriage is a personal gift in which the spouses commit themselves totally to each other. It is necessarily includes temporality. It commits for the future, and it commits for always. Fidelity is a natural dimension of love, and is for always, for overcome times. The third demand is the opening of this union to the transmission of life. Within the design of Creator, the stable and irrevocable union of a man and a woman is orientated not only toward the personal good of the spouses, but also to the service of life. The transmission of life does not depend always upon the will of the spouses, but opening to the transmission of life. In order to take up again the terms used in Encyclical Humanae Vitae, is an interior attitude that is always accessible. It is about the loving availability to present acts of which the possible consequence is the coming into existence of a new human being. According to Jean Paul II, the opening of the conjugal act to the eventual gift of life gives human love its fullness of beauty. He called the inseparability of the two unitive and procreative dimensions of the spousal union the ontological truth of the conjugal act, another forbidding word, ontological. We cannot use it anymore. The relativism almost cancel that word. You see how difficult it is to speak? No, we don't have any more a common language. No. The fact that this act of procreation may be, in its authentic form, an act of love contributes within Christian thought to associating creation and love in God. God created by love. He creates because he loves. Mercy and pastoral prudence. Christian marriage has its particular vocation to express a little of the mystery that unites Christ's disposed to his Church. The capacity to signify and to actualize the union of Christ and the Church belongs, in essence, to this community of life and love between man and woman that is marriage. In order to comprehend it, it benefits us to mention again the notion of this primordial union. It is defined also as a community of life and love, from Vatican II. It transforms by means of transmissions of divine goods by Christ, by means of communication of eternal life and eternal love. Communicate life and love by reason of their origin and their divine nature seal a union that is necessarily definitive. Between Christ and the Church, we have an eternal union. It is for eternity that Christ unites himself with those who are incorporated to him. The relationship between the gift of Christ and the gift that the spouses make of their lives is not only symbolic. The one and the other are two mysteries of love and the transmission of life. The sacrifice transforms into definitive victory over death, and thus into a victory over all of the infidelities of sin. We are in the presence of a divine fidelity, but expressed concretely in human nature. The irrevocable, indissoluble, and indestructible covenant of Calvary has rendered human nature capable of such an irrevocable, indissoluble, and indestructible union. The sacrament of marriage that the Church has the charge of celebrating is an act of Christ. The totality of norms that condition its validity is faithful testimony of this love of Christ, who, according to the terms of Vatican Council II, comes to the encounter of Christian spouses and abides with them, so that the spouses, by their mutual help, might love each other with a perpetual fidelity, as he himself has loved the Church and has delivered himself over for her. The love of Christ for his Church, by nature, a love that pardons. His fidelity expresses itself by the incense and purifications that fills her by his offering, constantly rendered present and communicate. The Eucharist sacrifice is the place where this union between Christ and the Church is reactualized. It is necessary that love of the spouse be sacramentally invigorated by this divine source in order to become a love that always is more capable of pardoning. It's interesting that people are far away from the sacraments and are far away of pardoning, forgiving. And many problems is because people don't forgive. Forgiveness is not only an act by which a grave offense is remitted, it is also a disposition of love that embraces the weakness, the sin, and the insufficiencies of the conjoined spouses. In this sense, it is an expression of the conjugal fides. To say, "I forgive you," is to say, "I make a covenant again with you." The insistence of the Church on the necessity for the spouses and the members of the family to forgive each other and to offer them the true means of reconciliation, the sacrament of penance, is an expression of her prudential pastoral care. And let me say that we need to insist to the Christian couples, don't forgive the sacraments. Otherwise, it will be almost impossible to live in grace, to live in love, to live in forgiveness. Love's capacity to offer eventual forgiveness attests to its authentic, and in so doing, verifies its origin. A love that excludes pardon is by definition destined to die. Ever since the original fall of man, it is always through a pardon offered that the love of God has been transmitted to men. God constantly remakes again his covenant, primarily with his people and then with each one of his sons. He ceaselessly reproduces them into his friendship. When the spouses are brought to pardon each other, they become better friends. They bring about the sublime testimony that love is stronger than death, and they carry within it, for this reason, the assurance of eternal life. Thank you.
Thank you very much, for your inspiring lecture, and you have
given us enough food for thought to ask for clarifications and also some questions. I was struck by the approach you have taken after explaining the divorce mentality, the sexual revolution, with the dualistic approach introduced in the very identity and nature of marriage, especially something which you haven't referred, but again, it's your speciality on bioethics. With the help of biotechnology, we are more and more introducing the dualism within marriage, that we are separating not only sex from love, but also procreation from the very nature of the human procreation and gender. But what struck me most is the anthropological, the 3 points you focus, the anthropological issues, that there are certain issues which are values, principles, which are not negotiable. And thirdly, this is the most important thing which we can also reflect upon, is the mercy and the prudence, what in the Catholic tradition has been termed as the prudential judgment when we face these situations in today's challenges, marriage and the family. I also was struck by your reference to Caritas in Veritate, because as you know, it is an encyclical which focuses on human development, and Pope Benedict XVI outlines new forms of poverty in today's society, not only the gap between the rich and the poor, but also the erosion of values, the erosion of the values, the traditional values of the family, the projection of new forms of models of marriage and the family. This is a new poverty in Western society, which we are exporting, unfortunately, to developing countries, thereby enhancing the poverty of values in these countries. And authentic value means the restoration of all these values, because technology and these models of marriages and family are becoming a new ideology, which is an enslaving ideology. Thank you very much, Professor Bachotei, for sharing with us your insights, your interpretation of Familiaris Consortio, and above all, for being so clear also in your exposition on the Catholic perspective of marriage and the family, which I think we need to make it more clear and to give more witness to civil society. I thank you once again for your participation and for presence.
You have just listened to the 15th Annual St. Augustine Lecture 2011. This lecture was delivered by Professor Alberto Boccati.